This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Jill Brenneman was only 14 years old when she was forced into the dangerous world of sex work. Jill was a homeless runaway. She met a man claiming to work in the entertainment industry, said he was going to give her a big break. Instead, he took her to a basement in northern Kentucky where he brutalized her and forced her to be what amounted to a slave. For years, he sold her body for money. Jill did eventually get away, but it took a while to free herself from the psychological shackles. Some scars remain. Today, she continues to work as a prostitute in Raleigh, but now it's on her terms, and she has become an outspoken advocate for women in the sex industry. She's the program coordinator for Sex Workers Without Borders, and she's here today to tell us her story and some of the problems surrounding sex work. Jill, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
We talked a little bit about your story and how you got a start. Tell us more about what happened when you were 14.
When I was 14, I was a throwaway teen. My parents told me they were moving and there would not be a room for me in the new house. And at that point, I was out. I was very filled with bravado. I had $107 in my pocket and decided I would hitchhike to Cincinnati to move in with a eighth grade friend who had moved there. And I got there, and her parents were not interested in harboring a runaway teen. And they called the police and told me I could either wait for the cops to get there or to I could leave. And I was terrified of the police. And at that point, I did run away from that. And immediately, with all of my financial sense, spent all of my money playing Space Invaders and Pac-Man and found that I had no money. And with no money, it meant there was no place to go, no way to get food. I found myself getting food out of dumpsters and trying to find places to get remotely clean and sleeping in cemeteries. And one rainy day, I was in a mall, and for whatever reason, mall security did not kick me out of the mall that day. And the most gorgeous guy I ever saw, who looked like my teenage crush, Lindsey Buckingham, walked up to me and started a conversation and told me everything I wanted to hear, that I was beautiful, that I was intelligent, and of course he picked out that I was a runaway in 2 minutes, and ultimately he was very charming, and he offered me an audition that I would need to go with him to audition, but assuming I passed the audition, I would have a job, which I wanted very much, and a place to stay, and if I didn't pass, he would still take me out for a steak dinner. And after getting my food out of Taco Bell dumpsters, I was up for that.
And he said he was in the entertainment business, modeling business, something like that.
He did. He presented himself as being a major entertainment agent, that he referred girls for entertainment reasons. He presented it as modeling. You know, we talked about the fact that I was 5'10 and thin. Except he wasn't.
Pretty quickly, you figured out, even on the ride to his so-called studio, that he was not telling the truth.
When we got out to his car, he told me that because he was such a famous entertainment agent, that he was very worried about corporate espionage and that I'd have to be blindfolded for the ride. And that felt wrong to me, but I needed what he had to offer. And I was also 14, and so I accepted it. And he talked me through it. He talked to me. We were going to downtown Cincinnati. He told me how we were going to his office building, but I could tell it was all wrong. The sounds were just completely wrong. I could tell we were going rural.
When you finally got out of the car, what happened?
When I got out of the car, I knew I was in a garage, and at that point, I was totally freaked out. I started to cry. He could see the tears coming out from under the blindfold. He kept trying to reassure me we were just going down to his lower-level office, but I knew I was going into a basement. And when we got down into the basement, everything changed. He wasn't trying to convince me of anything anymore. He leveled me with a backhand. And then he told me that I was not professional and that I would now have to do bikini pictures on stage to prove my professionalism. And he had me step up onto what was ostensibly a stage. He told me to put my hands over my head, and I felt him wrapping some kind of leather restraints around my wrists, and I was blindfolded. I didn't know what was coming. And at that point, I wasn't going to fight him anyway. At which point, the stage I was standing on, or the alleged stage, collapsed. It was obviously set up for suspension bondage, and I was hanging by my wrists.
That was the beginning, then, of a long period of brutal and sadistic torture.
Yes, 3 years.
At which point you were not only his personal slave, I guess you would say, but also he sold you to clients.
Yes, I was both his slave. I was the slave to his friends. We did many quote-unquote parties where I was the entertainment, for lack of a better word. But the majority of it, I was a submissive prostitute, meaning clients who were sadists, who wanted someone to dominate, would hire me for various role plays. And the bottom line was that I was not to give them anything in terms of reaction. I wasn't supposed to cry unless they paid in advance for me to cry. I wasn't supposed to beg unless they paid for me to beg. All those things were supposed to be negotiated in advance, and a lot of times it didn't work that way.
What do you mean it didn't work that way? You weren't able to play that role?
I wasn't able to hold up.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't stand, after the 100th time I'd been hit in the face or, you know, shocked with a stun gun or something. Well, not a stun gun, usually it's a cattle prod, but... Mm.
You tried to escape once, and that turned out to be a mistake.
I did. I tried to escape. A man named Brian posed as a client and convinced me that he knew who the pimp was. The pimp's name was Bruce, and he convinced me that he would help me escape, but it was actually a setup. The next night, he brought me back and to his house, and when I got there... They opened the door into the living room. Bruce was there. A lot of other men were there. And it was the most violent night of my life. And I never tried to escape again. I never wanted to endure what I went through that night again.
Eventually, though, you did get out. Bruce was arrested.
Yes, he was arrested on unrelated charges. I was locked in a closet. Bruce had developed a very strong cover for me. I had ID that said I was 19, and that in the event anything happened, I would portray his girlfriend who just liked rough sex and was going along with it. And the police, of course, found me in the closet and told me to put clothes on. And when I came back downstairs, they told me they were arresting him on unrelated charges, and I very weakly asked for a female officer, and they told me that if I wanted a female officer, there were plenty of them downtown, and that I would be able to speak to as many as I wanted to, that I would be placed into custody along with him, and I didn't go for that.
Wait, that sounds a bit like a threat. If you wanted to talk with them, you would also be placed in custody or arrested?
Yes, exactly. He would be arrested.
Yeah. So he went. They, for some reason, didn't want you to talk with female officers. He goes away, but you still didn't run away.
I still didn't run away. I had learned my lesson from the first escape attempt, and, you know, I would like to tell everyone that I was, you know, the female version of Jack Bauer and knew exactly what to do and escaped immediately, but I didn't. I went back into the closet and I waited for a day until I had to go to the bathroom so bad that I was forced to come back out of the closet.
And that's in part because you weren't allowed to go when you wanted to. You had to wait to be told.
Right. Even that was controlled. I was a slave, and slaves used the bathroom.
And we should explain, too, that on that first escape attempt, Bruce hanged you for a while by the neck, which has done some damage to your vocal cords.
Yes, it has given me this very Stevie Nicks-sounding voice. Mm.
Well, I want to continue this conversation because you have gotten away. You've done other work, worked as a DJ, a flight attendant, and now you're back as a sex worker and an advocate for sex workers' rights. And we're going to talk more about that as our conversation with Jill Brenneman continues on the state of things. She is program coordinator for Sex Workers Without Borders. We'll get a preview also of a conference that addresses ways to reduce harm to illegal drug users and sex workers and look at an innovative program fighting drugs in High Point. All of that coming up on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, today talking about drug use and sex work in North Carolina. Jill Brenneman is with us. She's a sex worker and program coordinator for Sex Workers Without Borders. Jill is participating in the first ever North Carolina Conference on Drug Use and Sex Work. It's called Reducing Harm and Building Communities, Addressing Drug Use in the South. It's going to be held in Durham at RTI International tomorrow and Friday. And joining us in the studio now is Robert Childs, Executive Director of the North Carolina Harm Reduction Coalition, one of the co-sponsors of the conference. Robert, welcome.
Thank you.
We've just heard a fraction of Jill's remarkable story. And Jill, I want to ask you about your work with Sex Workers Without Borders. Tell us about the group.
The group is a grassroots organization. Our primary objective is education. We educate on sex worker rights. We talk a lot about decriminalization and just basic human rights for sex workers. We do presentations largely at universities or public events. We've done some other different types of events.
How are sex workers' rights not honored?
Sex workers really have no rights when it really comes down to it. Because our profession is illegal, we have no ability to go to the police when we're assaulted, when we are raped, and which is a common myth that a prostitute can't be raped, but a prostitute can be raped.
Let me clarify this, though. Can you go to the police and say that you're raped? And that would be considered a crime, but the problem is then you would also have to be arrested.
Essentially, I'd be confessing. Yeah. I would be confessing to a crime, and unless I've got a very sympathetic officer, and I don't know who I'm dealing with. I mean, I personally, even as an independent sex worker, was violently raped a year ago by a client, and I was very brutally beaten in Dallas by a client. And I had no recourse. I couldn't go to the police to report this. I couldn't go to the hospital.
Have sex workers tried to do this, and what's been the result?
The result is that they oftentimes end up with a bigger problem. They end up with a legal problem. I didn't go to the hospital because I could not explain the bruises, which were staggering. And
Robert, your organization tries to reduce harm with regard to drug and sex work. First of all, is there a correlation between the two?
Absolutely. Oftentimes what we find, especially similar to what happened with Jill, is we find runaways that really have no options for economic liberation when they escape households for various reasons. And so what happens is the only way they can make money, especially in this economy, is to do sex work. But I know if, say, for example, you had to do sex work tomorrow to support your family, you know, I couldn't do that sober personally. So oftentimes they will use drugs in order to do the sex work to make ends meet. And what happens then is some people become dependent upon drugs in order to do a sex work, and they get stuck in a cycle of addiction. And when you get involved with drugs, oftentimes what happens is eventually you will become incarcerated at some point. And when you become incarcerated, then you can't really get a job anywhere. You can't get food stamps. You can't get education. Oftentimes you lose your right to vote, so you can't even change the system. And you can't get housing, so it's super difficult for people to break the cycle once they enter it. You know, there are exceptions of individuals who just do sex work and can be absolutely fine with economic liberation, but often what we encounter, especially on the streets of East Durham and over in Fayetteville, Raleigh, and also over in Greensboro and Winston, is that's not the circumstance. And oftentimes it's really sad.
Jill, is that your experience? Tell us about that correlation between sex work and drugs.
Fortunately for me, going back to my runaway teen story, my pimp didn't care how I felt. He didn't care whether or not I suffered or how I felt about the clients. I had very limited drug use. More of it sometimes was painkillers, just simply because I could not get through it. But I was very fortunate to never really get tied into that in that sense. But it wasn't because I wouldn't have fallen into it if I could have. It's just that he didn't want to expend the money.
Well, that can become another complication if you decide to go to the police after a beating or a rape. And then I would guess the next problem is, if you are doing this for pay, trying to prove in court that it was a rape would be the next hurdle. So what you're looking at is the unlikelihood that this man is ever going to be prosecuted and the high likelihood that you will be.
Exactly. And going before a jury of my peers in a society which looks down at prostitutes and has no idea why I'm a sex worker, nor would they care. It's hard enough as a rape victim who's not a sex worker to win that case.
Why are you still in the business?
Economic. It is entirely an economic reason.
Because you were for a while. You worked as a flight attendant?
I did. The airline went out of business, and then the economy crashed, and I simply can't live on. I'm single, and I can't live on the $8 an hour jobs that are out there right now. So I returned to sex work, initially through an agency, briefly, but found that that was not to my benefit, and returned to working as an independent escort through the internet, which is much safer for me because I get to screen my own clients. And if they get there, or I, you know, if I meet them or they meet me and I'm not comfortable, then I throw them out and that's the end.
And you're not sharing the profit with?
With anyone.
With anyone. Robert, tell us a little bit about your organization and its goals.
Sure. We're the North Carolina Harm Reduction Coalition, and what we are is North Carolina's only comprehensive harm reduction program. We do everything from grassroots advocacy to resource development to direct services all around the state. Most of our services are centered around the Triangle and the Piedmont, but we literally will go anywhere. And we work with people such as law enforcement in reducing their accidental needle sticks from working with people carrying syringes. We work with injection drug users. We work with crack users. We work with people who are prone to overdose. So say, for example, that could be anybody who's prescribed a opiate such as oxycodone. And for example, in North Carolina last year, there were 17 million prescriptions for our 9 million residents. So that's a really big issue. We work with sex workers. We work with legislators and working with them and to put in legislation that makes sense.
And what is some of that legislation that you'd like to see?
Sure. The large thing we'd really like to see is, one, syringe decriminalization. And the big reason we'd love to see syringe decriminalization is we have a lot of people in North Carolina that have to use syringes. So whether that be around our 700,000 diabetics, whether it be people getting cancer medication that needs to be delivered via syringe, whether it's an injection drug user, they need syringes to administer what they're going to do. And the big problem right now is it's at the pharmacist's discretion if you can be sold a syringe or not. And what we know is if you're a minority, you're 8 times less likely to be able to get a syringe from a pharmacist, according to studies done in North Carolina. And that's a really big problem because oftentimes pharmacists will believe that they're actually helping people by not giving them the syringe. All it does is make them reuse the syringe so they can get viral hepatitis C, HIV, abscesses, and all kinds of blood-borne diseases. So that's a really, really big problem. The other problem is it makes people not want to tell law enforcement they're carrying a syringe on them. And so when law enforcement do pat-downs, they're getting needle sticks, and they can get HIV or viral hepatitis that way.
And often the officer, in fact, I think always, the officer asks if you have anything else.
Yeah, they do, but they were if I was fearing arrest, there'd be no way I'd tell him.
You can't say that. Yeah. So to be able to own legals, to legalize needles is part of it. What about drug decriminalization?
That is something we're in favor of. We haven't done any advocacy around it in the state, but long term, we would definitely like that. And the big reason we'd love to do that is, one, it would decrease the amount of people in jail and prison. And right now, at the end of 2008, there are 5.1 million adults living under community supervision, which equates to 1 out of 45 people in the United States, which is absolutely horrendous. And we know 50% of those arrests were drug-related. And we know, due to the fact, 1 out of 8 African Americans are now banned from voting due to their incarceration record. And we also know it's been kind of race-related, which is a big problem. And we know African Americans are 10 times more likely than whites to be sent to prison for drug offenses when they make up a minority of the people using drugs.
Of course, here in North Carolina, a felony does not mean, if a felony conviction does not preclude you from voting once you've served all your time and your post-sentence supervision, right?
Yeah.
So you can serve, but in other states?
In states all around America, especially Florida, has a very bad record with that. And in the South, but it depends state by state. But we know nationwide it's a huge, huge problem.
And of course, then that compounds the problem of post-release orientation and reentry.
Yeah.
So the likelihood that you're going to take on these problems all over again is very high.
Absolutely. And especially because a lot of people lose their right to education, lose their right to food stamps, lose their right to housing, lose their a lot of their opportunities for economic liberation. So, you know, realistically, they have no other choice but to do sex work or sell drugs because they can't, you know, pay their rent. They can't support their babies if they don't have anything like that. And all their rights are being stripped when they get out, when they've served their time.
Now, Jill, you're advocating not legalization of prostitution, but decriminalization. Why?
I advocate decriminalization. I'm very much opposed to the U.S. model of legalization. The U.S. model of legalization exists only in Nevada, in several counties. And in those counties, you have to work through a specific brothel. If you work in the brothel, you immediately give 50% of your money off the top. Many times you cannot control the clients that you see in these brothels. On top of the 50% that you give away, you have to pay the fees for your testing. The clients do not have to be tested, so you don't know what you're dealing with a client. Essentially, legalization sets up, the state is setting up the brothels to be pimps, and the brothels don't care about the girls. The girls are commodities.
Would decriminalization make it any more likely that women would, or any sex worker, would report an offense if it was a misdemeanor and again, the likelihood of prosecution might still be low for the offender?
Under decriminalization, we wouldn't have the fear of arrest. Because it's decriminalized, I could go to the police and say that I've been assaulted and show the forensic evidence. And not have to worry that I'm not going to be the one that's going to end up in jail myself. Under decriminalization, I could work independently as I am, as opposed to being constrained to a brothel.
Well, I want to ask Robert a question about this. It becomes complex because you can hear Jill say, I want control of my own business. This is a business that's going to be around for a long time to come. On the other hand, the sex trafficking is a very different issue. That's people not in control of themselves, being sold into prostitution. And that's a very serious problem, not only in the South, but particularly, it turns out, here in North Carolina.
Yeah, we have a really big problem zones around military bases and the coast. And also, we see a lot of the human trafficking occurring for farm owners' need for farm labor. So we are seeing a lot of trafficking with that. And what happens with that, too, is due to our immigration policy, it oftentimes leads to power changes away from our government and the people of North Carolina and America to people you really don't want in control of these power and with the money, which are, you know, really dangerous people.
Such as?
Say, for example, it could be a cartel that's shipping people. Okay. And, you know, we're giving money to these cartels where, say, for example, if we didn't do that, We would not be having a lot of these issues and not be giving them power, and we'd have less border violence.
So what solves this? Is it decriminalization or is it better enforcement?
Probably a little bit of everything. I don't know if there's a single answer that will work for every single specific situation, but we definitely feel that decriminalization would definitely help out with that. But with the import of human trafficking versus the sex work issues that are just encouraged by our unacceptance of people of lesbian, gay, and transgender experience and intersex experience to individuals from low economic situations that then sell their children or make their children go into it. I mean, there needs to be multiple things that are used to address that.
Well, we're talking about innovative approaches to law enforcement. We want to turn now to a project in High Point. We talked about this a couple of years ago. They found a new way for law enforcement to tackle drug violence. It's called the High Point Initiative. It began in 2004. The goal was to find a way to close down open-air drug markets. Been extremely effective. Joining us by phone to remind us about that program and tell us how things have gone since last we spoke is Lieutenant Colonel Marty Sumner, Deputy Chief of the High Point Police Department. Welcome back, Marty.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having us.
Tell us briefly about the High Point Initiative.
These drug neighborhoods, after they get established, they're overt markets, and they are a draw for violence. They are a draw for a lot of different types, some of the ones you've just been discussing, violent crimes, street robberies, assaults. And when they get established, they're very, very difficult to abate. And we have had some here in High Point for a couple of decades until we tried this strategy. And the innovation here was to think more of it as a market problem rather than we had always tried to attack the supply or the demand. And those were not very effective. In this initiative, we looked at the market itself, what was the draw to the violence, and we used this strategy to shut down just the market, which would in turn reduce the violence there.
And tell us how it works.
And so since you got that strong market dynamic, you got to remove either the customer or the seller. And in this case, it's easy enough. There's a relative small amount of dealers who are the retail level dealers in a neighborhood, and they're pretty easy to identify through traditional methods, undercover work. You get all those guys identified, and primarily they were guys. The worst of the worst, the ones that had the violent records, you arrested and made examples out of them. The remaining guys, some of them were not even felons, who would be there to keep the business going if you didn't deal with them. Those guys we had made cases on but didn't arrest them, and we brought them into a meeting with the community group and said, the dealing in that neighborhood stops tonight. We've already got a case on you. We don't want to have to arrest you. These folks here want to give you some help. If you don't take their help, we will arrest you. But either way, the drug deal in that neighborhood ends tonight. In effect, we were able to touch all the would-be dealers. And overnight, we saw these drug markets collapse. And they were, as it turned out, very easy to sustain and keep those violent crime numbers relatively low to compare to what they were before.
It had to sound like a crazy idea to you, say, well, instead of arresting you, we're going to bring your neighbors into a room and have them tell you they don't like you anymore, but they will help you if you want to change your ways. That had to sound nuts to you in the beginning.
The gentleman, David Kennedy at John Jay College, who suggested this to us, he opened up by saying, give me 30 minutes before you think I'm crazy. And, of course, 30 minutes later, because the chief and I both had been in the business more than 30 years, and we tried everything we could think of, we said to ourselves, you know, that's not that crazy, and if it works, it'd be worth doing.
And it did work.
And in fact, it did work, and as it turned out, the benefits were way beyond anything we had imagined. It was a relative few number of arrests. The violent of the worst of the worst were in the single-digit numbers. A lot of the guys that we contacted years later still have not reoffended. And so that's great because most of our recidivism rates on groups are not anywhere near those numbers.
So you get a better recidivism, you shut down that market, and we talked about that the last time you were on. What has happened since?
And since that has happened, several places, for example, Department of Justice picked up the work, and through the Bureau of Justice Assistance, they've trained 24 cities across the country to do this. Many of them had the same experience. They've gotten some national and state awards for the work. So policymakers and police chiefs are taking note that, perhaps there is a different way to get at an age-old problem. And the real gem here is it's community-friendly. In the process of doing this work, we win back the trust of the community that we're trying to serve. And if it were only worth doing for that reason, that would be a good enough reason.
I want to thank all of you for opening our minds to some very creative solutions to some very old and thorny problems. Thanks so much for being on the program.
You're welcome.
On our program today, Lieutenant Colonel Marty Sumner, Deputy Chief Police of Police at High Point and the Police Department there. Robert Childs is Executive Director of the North Carolina Harm Reduction Coalition. Jill Brenneman, Sex Worker and Program Coordinator for Sex Workers Without Borders. The conference, Reducing Harm and Building Communities, Addressing Drug Use in the South, will be held tomorrow and Friday at RTI International in Durham. For more information, go to nchrc.net. Just ahead, Rethinking Aging with Dr. Norton Hadler. Stay with us on The State of Things.